Hey everybody, Nate here. Before the show, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com. or order from Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors and they support us. Thanks and Nihei Debiru. Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks. Hey everybody, Nate England here, and you are listening to Chop Talk. Today's episode is part two of my interview with my good buddy Randy Alley. In today's episode, we keep talking about some of Randy's skydiving stories, and then get into our times in Okinawa. Randy was there during NAM back in the 60s, and then visited again with me in 2004, I believe. So we talk about some of the ways that the island has changed over that time. Hope you guys enjoy. Thanks.
Somebody brought me a certificate, I signed it. I went out behind the building and I said, "You guys jump all you want." I looked at one of my packers and I says, "About every 10 minutes, just bring me another beer for a while." Oh, man. I knew I was dead. I mean, things are happening real fast.
Yeah.
And he just, one of my skydivers come to me the next day and he says, "You jumping today?" I said, "Yeah, I packed the reserves this morning." He says, "You okay?" I says, "Yeah, I'm fine." He says, "We watched that video 20 times. I says, "Good for you." He says, "How'd you ever figure all that out?" I says, "You want to know the truth?" He says, "Yeah." I says, "I don't have a freaking clue." I said, "It was going so fast. It seemed like it was slow motion, but I knew the ground was coming up. I kept checking my altimeter, and I just kept playing with it." And wow. I said, "I guess it just wasn't my time."
Wow.
I was lucky.
I guess he was lucky to be, you're the one he was strapped to, too.
I really didn't care. I finished what I was doing. I went over and got in my camper that I kept at the airport and went to sleep. I just was glad to be alive.
And you were back at it the next day.
Yep.
So, didn't faze you? Didn't make you think twice?
Oh, yeah. It makes you think and makes you feel more alive. You got to realize at this point in time, this wasn't a fun hobby to me. It was a business.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no different than if you go out and run a kata at a tournament and you mess up, that doesn't mean you're not going to be competing later on today in another discipline.
Right.
Weapons or kumite. Do you think about it when you go out?
No.
No, not really.
Yeah.
It's always there,
mm-hmm.
but I was a professional skydiver and you know, you do what you got to do, and it was my business, and I was the only tandem master, and I was the owner, and so you just do what you got to do.
Right.
So, yeah, I had a couple good ones.
Any situations where you got people up and they refused to jump?
Oh yeah.
You tell us about any of them.
I had a lady. I had her son, her husband, and her. Her son was first, husband was second, she was last.
Mm-hmm. These are all tandem jumps?
No, these are all static line. They're jumping by themselves.
Okay.
This was down at skydiving.
So static line is it, you hook something up to the air.
They're hooked to the airplane.
They jump out.
The static line pulls the parachute. Yeah. Okay. And this was down at Skydive St. Louis, and I was working as a jump master instructor before I had my own place. And in the plane, and sun jumps. Uh-oh, here we go.
Bless you.
Sun jumps, does a great job. Husband jumps, does a great job. I go around with her, and she says, I can't do this. I said, sure, you can do this. She says, I just can't do this. I'm sorry, I can't do it. I don't even know where it come from. I says, you know, you already done the hardest job in the world. I said, you had that baby boy. I said, this is just a walk in the park for you. She got up, walked, just scooted right over, put her feet out like I told her, went out and jumped. And I'm going, pilot turns around and looked at me, and he said, where'd you come up with that crap? I said, I don't know, it worked. And out the door I went.
Yeah.
That was one. And then I had, the funniest one I had was really pretty neat. There was a Gentry Car Sales. I probably shouldn't even mention her name down in Macomb.
You can edit it out. It's all right.
And this guy's a sales manager at this car lot. And mm-hmm. His dad's the owner, and his brother's there. And his brother is not the sharpest pencil in the box. And but you can tell that if he concentrates, he's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
And so the brother, all through class, is giving him shit, crap, one thing and another. Come the first break, I took the brother, older brother, out, and I said, you're giving your brother shit all the way through the class. I says, you're disrupting my class. And I says, I want you to stop. And he says, I'm pissing you off. I says, yeah. I said, just remember, I packed both your parachutes. Okay, I understand. Well, I just bought a car from these people.
And no one's going to be checking the way you pack them, because it'll be too late by then.
Right. So, guy is a real smart ass, and you got to learn to control those people.
Mm-hmm.
And before the class ever started, he had said he was going to have 10 people, and he only had 8. So we had done somebody wants money for something and instead you do a deal. What do they call that?
Oh, you bargained with him? You bartered with him?
Barter, that was
okay.
Well, I'd bartered this car for 10 skydives, see?
Oh, I see.
And so his idea. So two people wouldn't jump.
Mm.
And so before the class started, he says, well, I got to get something for those two people. I says, well, your model is you make your deal and that's it. I says, you made your deal, that's it. You don't get anything for free. A t-shirt or nothing. I says, t-shirts are $15 a piece. You made your deal, that's it.
Right.
There wasn't any t-shirts in the deal. I says, your people backed out. That's not my problem.
Looking for great entertainment? Want to find the best deals on food and drinks? Use the PubPal app to find great establishments near you. View daily specials, find live bands, karaoke, even poetry. If you're looking for something to do, PubPal is the answer, and it's only a click away. Download the app on the Apple Store and get the Android app on Google Play. And don't forget to like them on Facebook. Visit PubPalUSA.com to find out more. That's PubPalUSA. PubPalUSA.
So, anyway, I told him he had to straighten up and fly right. So, I kind of figured he was going to be a problem.
Mm.
And so, I put him and his brother on the same load, but I loaded him last to jump, and his brother second to jump, and then somebody else to jump, one of his other salesmen to jump first. The first guy goes, does a perfect job. His brother scoots over there, does just exactly. And I could tell the kid was just concentrating and totally focused during class.
Yeah.
All through his training, he was good. I wasn't worried about anything going wrong. He jumped, did a perfect job, went down, landed right where he's told to do. Mm-hmm. We had radios on him to guide him in. This guy gets his back to the dash and we go over, and you can let that door up easy and it just doesn't make any noise at all.
Right.
But I was feeling a little ornery, so I just let it go, and it just makes a lot of whoosh when the door opens, see? And this guy just quit breathing, you know, and his eyes got big, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I hit him in the chest and said, breathe. And he just says, when he got air, you know. He says, I can't do this. I says, oh, yes, you can. He says, what do you mean? I said, well, you're all hooked up. I says, your brother went out and did a good job. I says, now, think about this. You've had nine people come out, or you've had seven other people besides yourself come out here, and now you're not going to jump, and you're the last one. Mm-hmm. He looked at me, and he says, you did this on purpose, didn't you? I said, I knew you were a coward. I says, whenever somebody's always making fun of somebody else, I says, it's because they're scared. And I says, you're about to wet yourself. And I says, if you don't jump, I don't get to jump. If I don't get to jump, I'm going to be pissy. I says, now, I'm going to have the plane make a go round. And I'm going to tell you to put your feet out and stop. And I'm going to tell you to get all the way out. I'm going to tell you, look up. And then I'm going to tell you to go. Mm. And you're going to jump. He says, I can't do this. I said, okay, no problem. And he looked at me and he said, I says, do you want me to throw you out of the plane and just let happen what happens, or do you just want to go out and do it right? He says, you're serious.
He's going out of the plane one way or another.
Well, I never do this to anybody, but this guy's a real asshole. He kind of sat there a minute. He says, okay, I'll jump. Mm-hmm. So we make another go round and he still won't get out. Well, this is two. So we're burning fuel and there's other people to jump. So I said, okay, tell you what. You can either jump. I'm going to make one downwind pass and you can jump or we'll take the plane down. Mm-hmm. He says, okay, I can do it. I says, okay. So the spot's the same whether you're going upwind or downwind. When they leave the plane, they're still over the same spot. Mm-hmm. So we go over the spot. We're coming to it. And I says, put your feet out and stop. And he puts his feet out and stop. And so they got their hand on the door, you know, and they're going to go out and get hold of the strut.
Right.
And they get all the way out, and then you tell them to look up, and then you yell, go, and they leave. Well, he's sitting there with his feet on the step. I said, get all the way out, and he shakes his head, and he says, no. I said, get all the way out. And I just gave him a big shove.
And out he was. Out he went.
Well, I can't get him back in at that point in time.
Right.
I could, but I really didn't want to.
Right.
So out he went, and he did a head-first exit, and he was fine. I mean, the static line opened just like it was supposed to. It stood him up, and he went down and landed. I jumped behind him. I actually beat him to the ground. When I went by him, I'd give some kind of big laugh as I sailed by him in free fall. He was under an open parachute. And I went down and landed, and when he got down and landed, he was taking his stuff off. I said, what are you taking your stuff off? You don't take your stuff off out here. I says, wrap the lines up like we showed. He said, no. I says, if you wet yourself and you wrap the lines up, the parachute will hide it. And say he's in a jumpsuit. He says, okay. Well, he's not thinking of the fact that he's got to take the jumpsuit off. Right. He's just thinking that they're not going to see that he wet himself.
Right.
Well, he not only wet himself, but he crapped his pants.
Oh, wow. Oh.
So he kind of waddles over to the area, and he puts the parachute down, you know, and they get the harness and the helmet off of him and everything. They get the jumpsuit off, and they go, whoa, what happened here? And down his leg, he's a mess. And I'm just kind of giggling. I'm saying, this is justice. I walked over to his brother, and I says, why don't you go over to him and say, you little baby, you wet your pants and you crapped your pants. When are you going to grow up? He walked over there, and you know, the kid, he's like, he's done too many drugs in the 60s or something, you know.
Yeah.
And he goes over and he looks at his brother and he laughs and he points. He says, wait till I tell Dad you wet yourself and you crapped your pants. And he says, we're not riding home with you in the car. I looked at his brother. I thought, this is good. He says, what do you mean? I got to get back to Macomb or back to home. And he says, we're not riding home with you in the car. They made him ride in the trunk. it was hilarious.
And here he was, the big guy. He arranged the whole thing.
Yeah.
making fun of his brother. But yeah, you made a good point. I mean, yeah, if the guy, if the people that are scared are the ones that are going to make fun of the others, yep, that are going to, yeah.
They're either so quiet they don't say a word, mm-hmm, and that's apprehension, not necessarily fear. But when somebody's a cut up in class and they're making fun of other people, 9 times out of 10 they're just scared to death.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I knew I was going to have fun with him anyway. Mm-hmm. That's my dark side part of it, in a way. Yeah. I didn't like the way he made fun of his brother and the things he was saying to him. He was belittling him,
right,
and demeaning him. And now his brother has something he can hold on him his whole life. I did a perfect jump. You crapped your pants. You wet yourself.
Never live that down.
I'm like, this, you know, I told the guy, I said, just think this is for the rest of your life. You really did well. I guess people that know me know I can be pretty ornery at times.
Yeah, I guess so. So I guess the karate didn't get all that out of you.
Well, that was perfectly controlled.
Okay, that's controlled. All right. That was right in the gray zone, right?
Yeah, that was right in the gray zone. Perfectly controlled response.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's when you train people to jump and you jump, if the jump master doesn't jump with them, they're wondering what's wrong. So, mm-hmm, I had a rule that everybody jumped, and then there were some days we had so many students that we just didn't need to have the jump masters packing it. They were just going up and down, you know, mm-hmm, and everybody understood. And then at the end of the day, the jump master would go out and do a formation dive for them at, mm-hmm, the end of the day, something special, you know. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen too often, usually, you know, maybe once every couple months or so. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did have one lady. She was the first flight nurse in the state of Illinois. And she wanted, in the worst way, to skydive. And her son was one of my instructors. And I took her up and did a tandem jump. And I said, damn, it's cold in free fall today. And I got down and she'd wet all over me.
Ah.
And I was like, get this stuff off of me.
Oh, you know? Man.
And then I had Rose. Rose was one of the best. She was 87 years old.
Wow.
And the day I jumped her, grandson, her son, and her, three generations in the same day. And her son was a doctor, and he says she's got perfect confirmation, infirmity. She's good to go. She wants to go. So I took her up. She's an excellent student. Mm-hmm. We got down, and girls, I'd always say, how about a kiss for the driver, you know? And so got down with Rose, and I said, what'd you think of that, young lady? She says, I wouldn't have missed that for the world. I'm going to be at the star at the nursing home. And I said, how about a kiss for the driver? And she says, you bet. And I haven't kissed a young guy like you in a long time. And she was great. I mean, there were some real satisfying moments doing that.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing for you to do that, you know, at that age, to still be out and wanting to.
That was 87 years old and making a skydive. She was absolutely great. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's just, I had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah.
A lot of hard work. The most I ever did in one day was 14.
14 jumps?
14 tandem jumps.
Wow.
That was packing a parachute in between.
Up and down.
Up and down. I lost 14 pounds. And I was drinking about a liter of water between every jump. It was 105 degrees.
Man.
So if you ever want to lose weight and you want to get back to your Okinawan weight of,
yeah, I know, I'm 100, yeah, my Okinawan weight of 150 pounds, 155 pounds.
Yeah.
Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, coworker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks.
But hey, did you hear about the new skydiving record that got broken this week?
No, I didn't hear about that. What was that?
Yeah, absolutely. The couple went up, and it's the first ever documented case of free fall sex.
Really?
They jumped out of the plane and had sex on the way down, opened their chutes, and landed safely.
So I guess sex wasn't really the priority on that jump.
I guess you just had to remember to open the chute, you know.
I guess that's what you'd really call a quickie.
I guess so. You want to take your time on that one.
Well, you got to figure it's about 60 seconds from 12,000 feet.
So. Right.
So they must have looked like a rabbit or birds or something.
Yeah, you can probably check the internet. I'm sure it's on there. I think they had a cameraman too. So.
Jeez. Well, there's.
if you ever want to come out of your retirement, there you go. There's a record to beat.
You're probably not going to see me jump again. My wife said that I can jump anytime I want.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually thought about it.
Because there was some number you were trying to go for, a certain number of jumps or a certain...
Well, I'm at 1,895 skydives.
Okay.
And I'd kind of like to have my double diamond wings, so I need another 105 jumps.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's worth the risk.
Yeah.
My wife's first husband, before he died, was a paraplegic. And stuff happens real quick when you're skydiving.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get hurt doing karate or judo. You can get hurt walking across the street. But when you participate in a sport that is performed at 120 mile an hour plus,
mm-hmm.
then you're enhancing your chances of bodily injury.
Sure.
So... I don't think I want to put my wife through that again.
Yeah.
So I gave that up on my own.
Yeah.
She watched me jump a couple times, once at the skydive convention in Rantoul, and then she watched me jump in Hawaii once. Mm-hmm. So, but.
When was the last, when was your last jump?
2004.
Okay. So it was seven years ago.
Seven
years ago. So another thing I wanted to ask you about was, well, you and I were in Okinawa together.
Right.
That was 2004?
Correct.
2004. So we went over with Sheehan and...
John Morrell.
And we were there for the World Buddha Society. Morio Higaona's group had its big seminar. They have a big seminar. I think it's once every 4 years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
They had their big seminar. And so I wanted to ask you, I mean, you were there... You know, you were there that time, but you were there also back in the late 60s or early 70s, something like that.
Well, I was there prior to going to Vietnam.
Right.
And this
was before you were involved.
That was 65.
So this is before you were involved in karate or martial arts. You had no idea of the history of Okinawa. I mean, what were your kind of impressions of the place sort of before and then after?
Well, I was in... kind of elite unit, and they kind of kept our movements guarded, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was there, you could still get a ride in a rickshaw.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw one when we were there in 04.
No.
And it's back then, it was more like it was after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were there in 04, I was amazed at how commercialized everything was. Motorcycles, automobiles. It just kind of reminded me of New York City in a way. I mean, it was cars zipping around. And
mm-hmm.
never been to New York City, but I've seen pictures of it.
Right.
And I couldn't believe how it had developed since the 60s.
So when you were there the first time, there was probably still... I mean, huts with grass roofs, there was, like you said, there was rickshaws running around.
Yep.
This was, you know, after World War II, we took Okinawa and then didn't give it back to Japan until 72. So, I mean, it's still definitely under American control. We were basically running the island, and maybe they didn't have the same sort of updates at maybe Tokyo or other places?
No, not at all. They had electricity and stuff like that, but that island was pretty much basically destroyed during World War II.
Oh, completely destroyed.
And
You know, that's one thing that the people don't, I don't think people realize. When they talk about World War II, they talk about how bad Hiroshima and how bad Nagasaki was and stuff like that, which is horrible. But if you look at it, I mean, in Okinawa, they had something like 120,000 Japanese military died.
Yep.
About 40.
I think it was 30 or 40,000 Okinawans died.
More than that. Way more than that. It was about 14,000 U.S. and our allies' military died. And then they're thinking between 120 to 200,000 civilians died.
See, the Japanese, what they did to the Okinawans, they told them that the Americans were going to take and kill their kids and rape their women.
Mm-hmm.
They were scared to death of us, so they'd leap off the cliffs rather than have anything to do with us.
Yeah.
Finally, the word got out that we weren't that bad.
Right.
The Japanese took the Okinawans and put wooden guns in their hands and had them charge the American positions. And then when the Americans would fire, the Japanese would know where the Americans were, and that's where they'd shoot.
Yeah.
So they basically just use them like lambs to the slaughter.
Yeah, absolutely.
As decoys. And that's why there were so many casualties and... Island was flat.
Yeah. Just everything was destroyed. I mean, if you see the pictures...
If you see the pictures of Shuri Castle, there's nothing there.
You don't know that it's Shuri Castle. The caption says Shuri Castle, but there is nothing there.
It's just a pile of rubble.
Exactly. Exactly. There's nothing to distinguish it other than... I mean, you don't know what piece of rock is what. It's just a mess. But the... you know, some of the stuff that the Japanese military did was just... It's just horrifying. There's a couple monuments there to some of the schoolgirls who were basically acting as nurses. They were like high school students, and they were acting as nurses. And there's one lady who's still alive. At least she was a couple years ago when I was living there. She was in her 80s then, and. What happened? She was in high school, and she was a nurse. So anytime the Japanese soldiers were wounded, they'd bring them in and they would treat them. Well, when it became evident that the Japanese were going to lose the battle, the commanders of these units, because they had a Japanese military guy in charge of overseeing these nurses, they were ordered to distribute hand grenades to each one of the nurses. And to tell them to pull the pin, and if possible, do it near any American soldier so they take him out. And a lot of guys did that. And a lot of guys gave that order, and a lot of the gals died because of it. But this one guy, he said, "Look, this is not your war, this is not your fight. Just go home to your family. Just leave. Just go home to your family."
And she was one of them.
She was one of them. And so she lived. And so now she tours not just around Okinawa, but she tours around Japan, her telling her story and her experience about the war. Because that's real important, because I think that a lot of Japanese don't really know what happened.
Looking for great entertainment? Want to find the best deals on food and drinks? Use the PubPal app to find great establishments near you. View daily specials, find live bands, karaoke, even poetry. If you're looking for something to do, PubPal is the answer, and it's only a click away. Download the app on the Apple Store and get the Android app on Google Play. And don't forget to like them on Facebook. Visit PubPalUSA.com to find out more. That's PubPalUSA. PubPalUSA.
Well, you and I both know from being in Hawaii that the Japanese go to Hawaii to see Pearl Harbor because they don't teach that in Japanese history.
Absolutely.
They're disgraced by it. It was a sneak attack, and that's not honorable to them.
Right. Right.
And they, a lot of them feel that they lost the war because of that.
Right.
They shame themselves.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, they just tackled an industrial giant.
Yeah. Did not
Yeah, I don't think they expected it to
go. Well, Yamamoto, I believe it was, that said, "I believe all we have done is awake a sleeping giant."
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, when we were there, and not far from the hotel where we were, there was a commissa that was just sealed off, and that's where there was Japanese soldiers. Remember, I showed that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, here's something that I'm not sure if I told you this, but while I was living there, they were working on a road kind of in the southern end of the island, and that's where a lot of the heavier fighting took place.
That's correct.
And there's a guy working on the road with a backhoe, and he hit an old undetonated bomb.
It went off.
It went off.
Killed him.
He lived.
Oh man.
I do not know how he lived. I saw the photos of the backhoe afterwards. It's just mangled, just completely mangled. But somehow he lived. But this happened right across the street from an old folks' home, a retirement home.
Oh, good.
Blew out all the windows, just and blew them right in. This happened right during lunchtime.
Nobody was in the room.
Nobody was in their room. They were all in the dining hall. If anybody was in their room at that time, they just would have been covered in shrapnel. They would have died. It would just would have been a horrible mess.
Must have been a 500-pound bomb.
Yeah, it was. That's exactly what it was. That's exactly what it was. And
so they're still there. I mean, and they're still finding shells. They're still finding
the amount of explosives that was put on that island is unbelievable. I mean, the Japanese basically tunneled into rock. I mean, the Marines actually just took bulldozer and closed some of those caves off. Mm. They knew they were in there, but it wasn't worth fighting or trying to get them out because they were going to fight to the death.
Right.
The number of Japanese prisoners taken, well, I mean, here about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, I remember they found a Japanese soldier on one of the islands. He thought the war was still going on.
Yeah, he had just been hanging out in the jungle.
In the Philippines.
Right, that's right. And that was really recently. Like you said, it was about 15 years ago, right?
Yeah. They lived by a different code then.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean,
and then the
kamikaze pilots and fighting to the death, and it's a disgrace, and that's why on the Bataan Death March so many of our guys were killed.
Mm-hmm.
It was just because they thought it was disgraceful to surrender.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't expect all these Americans to surrender. They didn't know how to deal with that. It's you fight to the death or that's it. You don't surrender.
Nope.
And so they were shocked. They didn't know what to do with all these people, so they just marched them and they died. And that was another thing that happened in Okinawa as well. The commander down there, he when he realized that the battle was not going their way, he got on his radio and he issued one final command. I order everybody, every soldier, every civilian, everyone to fight to the last man. And then he killed himself.
Yeah.
That was it. Yep. There's your orders, everybody.
Well, you know, they had so many people in those caves that they actually had concave areas in the caves, and they slept standing up.
Oh, man. Yeah. It is just horrifying, some of the things that went on there. The peace memorial down there, the war memorial, it's a really great memorial because
it's different than some of the other ones, because even if you look at the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., it's all the Americans that died. It's a good memorial. But in Okinawa, what they have is they have everybody's name. So they have all of the Japanese military, they have all of the American, British, and all the military, they have all their names, and they have all the civilians also. And there's just, it's incredible to see because they have sort of an observation area up above, and it's just this row after row after row after row after row, and you're looking at, you know, a quarter of a million, 300,000 people's names, and they're all, you know, like a quarter of an inch tall or something, but it just takes up the area of a, you know, bigger than a football field.
Mm-hmm.
With all these names on it, and they have a real good museum with some different artifacts and explaining sort of the situations and photographs and things like that. But another thing about it was, you know, the Japanese never really considered Okinawa as, you know, truly part of Japan. So it was almost like they just sort of gave it away, just to slow down the mainland invasion of mainland Japan.
That was the plan.
Yeah. So just slow it down, and we don't care how many of these people die. They're not really Japanese anyway.
They're expendable.
Exactly right. And but I think the Americans were also surprised from some of the things I've seen, because they had been going to some of the smaller islands, Iwo Jima, Midway, things like that, which really...
Tarawa.
Exactly.
Saipan.
Exactly. Which really weren't inhabited... They were inhabited. There were a few people living there, but it wasn't like Okinawa, where there's a massive population of a
million. No, the island, like the Marianas and stuff, they weren't real heavily populated.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a couple of villages here and there. So I think that was another thing that surprised the Americans landing there, was just how many civilians there were and how developed the island was. Well, before the battle, anyway.
I'll tell you what, it was a bad deal.
It was.
They had people using motor oil to cook in and killed them.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I remember about, a lot of the people that I met over there, you know, because I'm working out at these karate schools, so I'm working out with all these guys that are, 60, 70, 80 years old, and so they were all around.
Kind of like me.
Yeah, kind of like you. Exactly. Kind of like now. So, it's, you know, same here, same back there. You know, I'm working out with all these old farts, but... But you're kind of tentative to talk about this with some of these guys, but some of them they'd start talking about their experience kind of on their own. You weren't like, hey, what was it like in the war? They'd just start talking. So I was out with, drinking with this, this one guy, Shiroma Sensei. He's a real, real nice guy. He gave me a gi, and it was always fun to talk. He spoke English, fairly well. He was a tugboat captain for years, and so he would push in all the different Navy ships and stuff like that, so he learned how to, you know, get by in English. But we went out for a drink one night after class, and he was showing me, you know, the edamame, like sort of the beans. Mm-hmm. Those green, so normally if you're eating edamame, you just kind of put them in your mouth and you bite down and you suck out the little green beans inside, right, and eat that. But he says, no, during the war, we couldn't just throw away, the shell. We couldn't just throw away the husk. So he showed me how to, basically, you take the, after you eat the bean, after you eat the edamame, you pull off, there's this little sort of hard, waxy coat on the inside. So you pull that off on both of the sides of the husk. You put that in your mouth, in your teeth, and you bite down and you pull, and so you can eat the husk too. So this is, he's like, this is what we had to do to get by, because there was...
No food.
And the other people are starving, so they had to get by with whatever they had.
That was pretty sad.
It was real sad.
Same way with Vietnam.
All right, guys, I hope I didn't bore you too much with my bean-eating stories, but that does it for part two of my interview with Randy Alley. Part three is coming up next week, and in that one, Randy talks about some of the ways that he dealt with what he experienced in Vietnam. It's an interesting show, so I hope you guys tune in. Thanks. Hey everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks.